Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
5 months ago, an EF3 tornado blew through St. Louis, killing 5 people and causing at least $1 billion of damage. All 8 neighborhoods in the ward represented by Alderwoman Shamim Clark Hubbard were hit. 2 of her constituents died. Recovery, she says, is uneven. Some of her residents have been able to repair their houses and move back in, but some are still living in seriously damaged homes or in tents on their property. The 10th Ward Alderwoman joins me next on the latest episode of Politically Speaking. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We've seen a county government that has had smooth and steady leadership, and I think we're on a good path right now.
I realize the office needed a prosecutor to run it.
And we have a better solution of addressing those needs.
I don't think it's about a popularity contest. What I think it about is it's time for change.
Working together across city and county, across political affiliations, that we can start to find overlapping goals.
I had some moments where I had to, you know, lean into my courage.
You'll see us work together on areas of agreement, and you'll see us have difficult conversations when we don't agree.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Rachel Lippman. Joining me in the studio today is
Shamim Clark Hubbard.
She is the Alderwoman of the 10th Ward. And remind our listeners roughly the boundaries of that ward.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Rachel. You know how excited I was to be here and share this space with you. The 10th Ward has 8 neighborhoods. The furthest southwest point is Clayton Road and Skinker. The furthest northeast point is Taylor and Martin Luther King. And then I have like the entire Forest Park in the 10th Ward. Very diverse, again, neighborhoods.
You were obviously familiar with politics. You and family members have been in and around it for probably your entire lifetime. But what did you learn about the actual act of legislating and running for office during these last 6 years?
You know, the legislating part was the part that I learned the most. Being around politics all my life, again, since I was a little girl following my grandfather, who was a former alderman in the 4th Ward, and up until then marrying into politics, and just being around and wanting to engage in civil engagement, rather, across in different areas. I knew about running a campaign. I could do that. I knew the ups and the downs, the wins and the losses, right? But the legislating part and being able to work with the 28 and now the 14 was a skill that I think I continue to home and I'm proud of. You know, I've legislated about 200 bills now, either through sponsorship, co-sponsorship. And so each one of them have taught me something. That's from the biggest, the heaviest ones, right down to a speed bump bill, you know. So, and it's what I love now.
And so what are the learning curves different between the big bills and the little bills? Like, what do you learn from those big, heavy lifts, like civilian oversight structure, down different from a speed bump bill, for example?
I think it's just the players, right? And so most times it is learning who's at the table, who has real agenda on it and who doesn't, who's at the table to just be, and there's one in all of these, in every legislative process, someone's just there to basically obstruct, you know, don't really want a solution for it. And so just learning the different players in these legislative processes, getting to know policy and people that would be for or against it for a myriad of reasons. Again, I treat every one of them individually in the same and with the same amount of effort that I do. But as I learned, it's just more about how people, again, their own nuances, their own cadence in legislating. And that goes for not only my colleagues, but interest, the interest in the parties that are engaged. It's been the learning curve that I'm still getting around because it changes. But again, I enjoy it. Understanding my role, that's big. In the legislative process, I fully understand my role. I fully understand what I can and can't do. If I don't, I figure it out. I find out. I learn about it so that nobody can try to distract me with stuff I can't do or try to distract me and pull me away from whatever the goal is, which I know an obstructionist or somebody that wants to just create division and divide will do. So that's one of the things I think that has made me effective in legislating as well.
Is there a bill that you can think of where maybe you didn't fully understand that role initially and it led to, you know, the obstruction winning?
I really can't say. I'm trying to think, and it might come to me later, but no, I can't say that I didn't understand my role again. I really studied it. I don't take it for granted, right? And so I don't really get caught off in a lot of things that would get me out of the role that I'm playing. So for that, what I think the obstructive part in some of the bigger list that I've had that I'm still very proud of, legislation that I've carried and passed, is that when they try to play me on a role on the back end. So it's like I understand my role of legislating. For instance, if I legislate something and it creates something and I'm not on the implementation or this another part of it, then I'm still proud of the work I did because it wasn't my fault or necessarily my it wasn't my role or my fault that it might have went away after we created it. But the legislative part, the creation of it, the mission of it, the vision of it, I still believe in all of the bills that I've carried.
And we will talk about some of those big pieces mm-hmm. of legislation that you have carried. But I do first want to touch on, we are about 5 months out of the devastating tornado.
Yes.
How did you and your loved ones and family fare in that?
Rachel, I don't even talk about my own specific thing because of what I see every day still now, 140 plus days later after the tornado. I still see devastation. You know, the 8 neighborhoods that I serve in, I was just in one where they're still dealing with stumps and not having street lights and sidewalks are messed up and getting their roofs repaired. But here's the difference. They are getting their roofs repaired. I can go in another neighborhood and see a constituent whose house still looks like May 16th. And they don't know which way to turn. Listen, I've been going back and forth with the insurance company and dealing with stuff on my home, like I said, but nothing compared to what I see. And not to mention, if you know, we lost two of the lives lost. Mm-hmm. We're in the 10th ward. So nothing will be the same for those families, you know. And things, when you think about it like that, it's like I don't even have time to really process myself other than to try to just get it done so I can be available and accessible for somebody else.
But what I am hearing is that while you don't talk about it, you are dealing with many of the same things that your constituents are dealing with and trying mm-hmm. to sort out your own personal impact.
Yeah, that's with everything, though. Okay. It comes with the territory. And again, I don't take it for granted. So, you know, you just keep going.
You've talked about recovery seeming a little uneven throughout parts of the ward. What do you think is the main driving factor in that uneven recovery?
Wow, we would need a whole nother politically speaking show, Rachel. I mean, because you have to think it started before May 16th for many of these people. And again, the factors that got them to the position that they were in May 16th, again, was different. There was a disparity in that alone. And I'm just trying to meet my constituents where they are, ask them to tell me, beg them at this point to tell me what they need and how I can help connect the dots for them and not lie to them, right? I don't tell them things I can do that I know I can't. And so I think that's the biggest thing, too. Sometimes it's going back and forth about what people expect and what people want you to do and think you should be able to do. And then when you know you can't, it's not only heartbreaking, but I think it's better for me to tell them the truth up front and connect them to the people that can versus going back and forth about what I can't.
And what are they telling you about the needs that they have?
Well, some of them, you know, at this point, it's funds, you know, creating pathways for them to get some kind of different funds to meet and sometimes fill in the gaps, but sometimes be the gap. You know, some of them, again, I mentioned un or underinsured. So we're talking about three-course brick homes. Some of them, we had elders in them that have been paying insurance for decades, 90 plus years old, and their payouts were like $40,000.
Which is nothing for a three-story brick house.
That's nothing. And that's not to mention if the house needed any repair prior to May 16th. And now 140 days later, being open to elements and all the different things that have been going on, what it's like. And so I think creating a different programming around funds and making sure they know how to access them, helping them get their paperwork right. I just had a session with Legal Services of Eastern Missouri and Michael Butler, our collector of deeds, because for some people the barrier was they didn't have a clean deed or they didn't have access to their paperwork.
Are there things that you think you or the city should be providing, needs that the city should be meeting that it isn't right now?
Yeah. And the city is not at this point, I won't say it's not, I think it's just a delayed time. I think many of us are fighting for the things we need. So at this point, I know and fully understand the city cannot just pass over money to constituents. For this, process is about putting it in programming, but having it easily accessible and attainable for them. Low to no barriers to be able to get these funds. So listen, debris cleanup, again, we are behind on that. I do believe we are behind on that. And it's not because of the size. I mean, I saw how it happened at Clayton, you know, where the city meets Clayton. I was over in those areas and just saw the
That's your ward, yeah. I think, right? You go right up to the western border of the city.
It's right up against Clayton. So some of my blocks, you can stand in 1 foot in the person's yard and be in Clayton and one and be in the city of St. Louis. And so I saw the difference, and we are catching up now. We are absolutely a bigger area, absolutely more needs. And so I think that us working together is what's going to make the difference. When people trying to pick stuff off and do stuff in their silos, it just causes disruption for so many reasons. So I think that one of the things that we could do better that is just making sure that people follow up, meet people where they are, and then just tell them what it is. You know, be clear and concise on the policies and the procedures for it so that people can get the access to it. We are getting ready to get into a new season. I heard this morning that we are projected to have a bad winter. So I am beyond, I will say, scared, and I don't fear a lot of things, but for these constituents that are out here either mostly by choice, at this point, still living in some of these very, very dangerous properties or intense, or some of them are going back and forth in their cars into these dangerous properties. Because, again, as they continue to be open and accessible to these elements, they get worse, not better. And what they may have asked for and thought they needed in the beginning now, I'm sure, has changed. And so it's just, again, trying to figure out what those are for the specific people, create the avenues, and get it out the ground on the door. I mean, to their door. Yeah, I'm frustrated with that. I wish there was a way. If we can't do direct payments, maybe do some kind of endowments or low to no interest loans, or, you know, with an incentive to stay, right? Mm-hmm. So not to give people money to relocate, but these people, I have constituents that want to stay. They want to stay, and I want to fight for them to stay as much as I can. Again, I can look them in their face, and my heart and my mind and my spirit, I won't lie to them, but I will tell them what we can't do.
How would you say the city's response to the tornado has been overall, and has your view of the response changed the longer we get away from the day it touched down?
Yeah, my view probably changes almost daily, but it's also guided by my constituents. So, you know, again, I have some that are okay, you know, that they are, and they actually compliment. But I have some that once I find out just where the factors are, they just feel left, you know, unheard, forgotten about. And so for me, it's always been answer the call, follow up, to your point, tell the truth, and connect the dots as much as I can. And it's not just government sometimes that has misled my constituents. Unfortunately, it's been outside interests as well that have misled them on how they can move on a pathway forward. And that's okay. That's in all politics and in all governments. But again, just being there, I think I can't really get caught up on the bad days because I have to keep pushing forward for the good days. And I always keep the lines of communication open. I work very closely with Mr. Nix and the Office of Recovery that Mayor Spencer has set up, and Mayor Spencer, for that matter, and my liaisons there in her office. So I think that, again, even from the challenges to the compliments and the wins, I share it all so that we can all stay on the same page, if not for just in the 10th Ward, but hopefully for the entire path of the storm to move forward.
What has been the common theme among the residents who have told you that they feel left behind, or have told you that they feel that the city has ignored them?
Yeah, they need funds. They need funds. And again, for me, I have to be honest with them and tell them, well, there's lines of how the city can help fund you. There's programs and policies how the city can help fund you. And let's sit down. Let's talk about what those are. Let's get your paperwork in order so you can apply. Let's get in and see how we can meet these needs where they are and then move forward. And hopefully there'll be more programming moving forward. I mean, we're still waiting on some of the programming from the state, $100+ million. And we'll still be waiting on some of the FEMA reimbursements to see how we can program them. CDBG funds, affordable housing funds. You know, there are different ways. Here, listen, I'm hearing now some outlying ARPA funds. God forbid.
How we still have ARPA funds October 25,
but
hey, we do.
But listen, so I'm like, at this point, please, the powers, sit down, figure it out, get the funds so that we can deploy them and get them on the ground.
What does your ward really need to truly recover? Obviously, resources, but what in addition to those resources does your ward need?
Well, the resources will bring the housing. The resources will re-stand up a lot of the businesses. I lost also in addition to some of the, in all eight neighborhoods of housing, I lost the most or had the most impact the number of businesses in the city of St. Louis in the 10th Ward that were hit again. Where I see some rebuilding and recovering, like King Customs on King's Highway. He's got new lighting and he just put his new sign up. So excited for him. I see some that are still sitting with their fronts ripped open, with the buildings ripped open. And some that are going to have to unfortunately come down. Historic buildings that are going to have to unfortunately come down. Let's talk about the churches, that are going to have to come down. The schools, I only had three St. Louis public schools in the 10th Ward. Two of them lost in the tornado. So the resources, I think, will bring that housing, that infrastructure, and then the businesses, which, create waterfalls for many things, not just housing, but density and safety, for that matter. And then bringing the people, making sure that people still feel welcome. I want all of that to happen, Rachel, with everybody that wants to stay not feeling like they're being kicked out. And that's a real that's a real thing for me to be fighting for. I'm not afraid. I always said I'm never afraid of the gentrification boogeyman. You can't scare me with that. But I don't like the displacement that comes with historically some of the gentrification that's happened. I want all of that comes with gentrification to happen with the people that are here that want to stay, and then the influx of the people that want to come and join us.
So how do you realistically protect those residents, protect your ward mm-hmm. from the bad things that come from gentrification, mm-hmm. the displacement, etc., when, some of them are already displaced from mm-hmm. their community? How do you protect those who want to stay?
They say God ain't making no more land. So for me, it's making sure if that's all you're going to have, hang on to it, hold on to it. And then we might be able to put you in something, a programming through CDA or affordable housing, or the SLDC might come up with some housing program where we can rebuild there. Okay, and then making sure that the communication, the access, the presence is there. Not just for me, but for them. So for me, just imagine, I've always been the type of elected official that if somebody comes to me with something that's going to help happen for the greater good for the community, you have to talk to us. You don't just talk to me first. I almost feel bad if I talk to them personally in my own spirit, feel bad if I talk to them first without talking to the community. That's why I'm always trying to strengthen my neighborhood organizations and association so that they're in place, so that they might have committees or themselves can come and we can say, let's sit down and talk and let's make sure this is what the neighborhood wants and how the neighborhood will work together on it. And with every project I've done, big or small, that I've opened up and introduced to the community, that's the way I've done it and that's what I'm known for.
What did the tornado and its aftermath teach you about the city?
More patience, more again, more need to manage expectations. You think everybody's going to answer the call and follow up the way that you do, and that's just not the case. So, listen, if I'm getting on your nerves, I'm sorry, but I'm going to get on your nerves because you have to do this. I feel like we have to do this. We have a responsibility to do this. Also, some of the spending mechanisms I wish we could change. I mean, the fact that and I may, at this point as we speak, still have a house from May 16th that's blocking a alleyway. It was a vacant property prior to, and that's a barrier right there. It fell over into the alley. So now those residents can't get back and forth through their alley. Recovery can't happen for some of them because trucks need to get back and forth to their homes. And the house is still sitting in the alley for a myriad of reasons, not because I wanted to, not because at this point I think the city wants to, but there's contracting, there's which money pot can this come from, there's finding the company that can do it, because it's not just like we can send our own city debris removal over there because it's a house.
Who's even the owner of the vacant house?
But getting to that, getting to that when it's private property versus if it was LRA or city owned. And so, again, learning all of those different nuances of processes, but still fighting for them fighting through them, rather, is what's been important to me. Because what I know and what I've learned is I see now why some people probably just throw their hands up and walk away. It's a lot in government.
And we'll be right back after a quick break. And we're back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Back on Politically Speaking with 10th Ward Alderwoman Shamim Clark Hubbard. And Alderwoman, what are some of the legislative priorities you have for the second half of what is your second term?
Yeah. Well, ADUs was big on my list. So proud to say we got that one out over the finish line. Again, just making sure that I'm in position. So whatever the development and the economic engine that I wanted to grow and make out of the new corridors I had in the 10th Ward between Kings Highway, between Del Mar and Martin Luther King, and then Del Mar going up, and Martin Luther King, of course. Now I have Martin Luther King from Union to Taylor, just on the south side. But those were big priorities of mine. I was went in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm going to pull these businesses together. We're going to do all this. Then the tornado hit on May 16th. So now, again, my priorities and my visions, that they haven't gone away. But they are kind of shifted to make sure, again, I can be in position and creating policy that doesn't have unintended consequences that would, make it hard for people to stay. But on the contrary, trying to put things in place that would help them stay, incentivize them staying and move forward so that by the time we're going into our third term in the 10th Ward, we'll be able to look back and cutting ribbons and doing housewarmings and opening new businesses that hadn't been in the city while making sure we keep uplifting businesses like Coogman Motors that's been there for 100 years on North Kings Highway, for that matter. You know, so I think my priorities now, probably always my commitment to my constituents and my businesses is the same, but it's just about making sure we stay.
You mentioned the accessory dwelling unit bill. That's mm-hmm. a granny flat, carriage house, mm-hmm. whatever language you want to use for it. The city's also going into a big overhaul of its zoning mm-hmm. code mm-hmm. and kind of tie those two issues together for me. What did you learn in doing the accessory dwelling unit bill that should inform, or you think should inform, the city as it rezones?
Yeah, well, actually, it kind of went vice versa. So, I started that zoning bill legislation in 2023 working with ARPA and AARP, working with AARP. And
the same letter is a little different.
Right. And the housing, the St. Louis Realtors, Missouri Realtors. And that was about creating Disney, that missing middle housing, bringing infill housing in so many different ways. There's most ways more affordable and more accessible. Streamlining that process, because prior to this, you initially got denied, period, flat denied in the city of St. Louis, which adds additional time, which adds additional money to the process. And most of them I learned through, if not all of them, actually, I learned through our zoning administrator, Mary Hart Burton. They still went through the process, and they still got them done. We have some beautiful ADUs here in the city of St. Louis already, but it just took more time and more money. So this makes it more accessible, which speaks into what the zoning overhaul wants to do as well. And so I think that they really pair each other. At one point, the city of St. Louis, if you know the houses that I serve, they were built with carriage houses for real carriages. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this
you
was already
to have a carriage and a horse to get around.
Exactly. So it's like it's nothing new. But at some point, this and other things in the city of St. Louis zoning took a turn. And we know that. And this zoning overhaul is a way to right a lot of the wrongs, discriminative wrongs that have happened in the city of St. Louis. And I'm excited about the zoning overall process.
What are some of the other bigger needs in zoning that you have seen in your work on HUDs and with your work on SLDC that you want to have as part of the conversation about the overhaul?
Just which we already did some of the impact of the lot sizing, the uses,
And that lot size is you can put a house on a smaller lot.
Yes, which was big. And who knew, Now, we need them more than ever. But I think, again, just a lot of the different ways that we can sometimes keep a bad practices out as well as welcome bad good practices in are the things that we're going to be doing and exploring. And that process, what I've loved about it is that it's so public.
Civilian oversight of the city's public safety structures was one of your big lifts from your last term. Mm-hmm. It basically created a separate division within the public safety department that handles both the jail and police oversight boards. Mm-hmm. I think I kind of know the answer to this question from some of your previous, the conversation earlier in the podcast, but is that structure working the way that you wanted it to, doing what you thought it would do?
No, it's not. But I don't think you give up on it. Again, this is one of the things I talked about and I touched on when I said you have a vision and you have a mission that you want to create and with this legislation. And the role of an alderperson is to do that. But once you pass it and you feel good about it and you want to, you pray that you put it in the right hands, right, and that the right departments or the right leadership will carry it out and have it move in the right way. Or not hinder it, God forbid. And there are factors in there, again, that we could have never prepared for. We wouldn't have prepared for state takeover, you know, and what that now looks like to civilian oversight, you know. And so, again, these are variables that we couldn't control, but that doesn't mean that you don't try. And so I know that there are challenges with that on both sides of it, both on both boards and on both sides, being inside the entity and the oversight boards as well. So my position in that, again, when I say I understand my role, I know I can't. There are certain things I can do, but I know being in advocacy and support for them to function, to do what they are supposed to do, is the position that I stand in and I remain in.
From your understanding, your insights, the information you are getting, where did implementation go wrong?
Just, I think there was a, man, it's so many different things that I can say. I mean, I think that they were trying to pick up a baton that was already kind of cracked. And so when they had changes within the administration, changes within the leadership and the departments that were charged with administering and these boards, those type of things were barriers. And anytime you add more time and confusion to policy and procedures like this, it always delays it. And it takes away from what it was supposed to be. So a lot of them, for lack of a better word, got hijacked in the work. And then when the people on the board may have gotten into different situations where they couldn't really properly function the way they needed to, then all of those things was like a quiet storm of how it would never work. So I think people don't really think about leadership and how it trickles down, administrations and how they trickle down, and how who they appoint into administrative and leadership positions and how that trickles down. So hopefully when you have the right people in position that want to do the right thing, that stuff will get done. But I think we saw a lot of hiccups in that in both boards.
Is that leadership now in place?
We'll see.
Are there legislative fixes that you think could help this, or is this truly all now on the side of the department and the division?
I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of these things that people bring up, I don't think people really understand that they're not legislative fixes. They're administrative fixes. They're policy that the administration and the departments were charged to create fixes. And so sometimes the attention that the legislative process can bring, be it through resolution or sometimes, unfortunately, a board bill, can push that change. But a lot of times, people, if they really wanted it to work, they would do things to change it now. For instance, like we just did a quick change to some funding that goes for violence prevention in the city of St. Louis. And the quick change that would help, and we got this from the providers, was changing the dates of the grant, changing the dates of the RFP. So that's not legislative. That's an easy, quick change, you know, but we can do it through resolution. We can talk about it. We can promote it and support it. But it can just get done. And I think there are a lot of things in the city of St. Louis, and that can take me even back to the tornado response. They're not legislative. Just do them.
So give me an example. What is a thing, whether with tornado or civilian oversight or any of your other legislative priorities, where you want to just yell at the person, you know, as Nike says, just do this?
Right, you gonna give me in trouble? I'm just kidding. I think that it just takes a lot, and I would love for somebody to draft this and see what this looks like. How long it takes a dime to move in the city of St. Louis, you know. So I do think that there are some ways that we can streamline the process of funding here in the city and acquisitions programming. For that matter, which, again, we just giggled about that there's still some ARPA funding. We legislated that forever. We have several bills that we legislated for ARPA, and this money that's still sitting there. We have bills that we legislated for great programs of ARPA that got mixed up in controversy and are now still sitting there. You know, so I just think that, and these are not legislative fixes because they weren't part of the legislative process that took them awry. And so just identifying where those gaps are and where those needles are. But again, that talks about who's in those positions that really wants to do it, makes a difference. Then that'll be, those are the things that I would talk about. But I think I better not talk about anything specific on that because I might get in trouble.
I do want to talk about one controversial tranche of ARPA money that just kind of keeps popping back up in the news every once in a while, and that's the grants to the Northside businesses and nonprofits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You did sponsor a bill to expand the eligibility of those grants from specific commercial corridors to what was a much broader swath of North St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Why?
When that legislation came to me, first of all, the first time, I was 100% for it under our former president and my colleagues, former colleagues there.
And that was for just the specific commercial corridors.
Yeah, and those specific streets. And it was brought to the attention from SLDC, once they tried to really try to create and move their programming, that some of that would be challenged. And so that's when they opened it up to the EGI 1, EGI 2, you know, different things that they could do to make it a more legal programming for that fund. And noting
and
that
these are standards, it sounds like, that are set either by SLDC or the federal government.
Both.
Okay.
Impairing, they do. And so that was brought to me to change it to that, to not take away. And what I love about our meetings, our legislative meetings, committee hearings, and on the floor, this all recorded, you can go back and watch it. I fought to make sure that we kept the same mission and vision and spirit of that funding, but made sure that it was a legal thing that couldn't be challenged, for that matter, to get it on the ground. Again, this created the fund. This did not create the program. It did not create the process. It did not create and put in place the implementation. It just created and made a pathway for the funding to create this fund.
You do serve on the board of SLDC in your role as head of HUDS.
Yes.
And the expansion did make relatives of yours eligible to get funding from that program. Mm-hmm. I know you recused yourself from the SLDC vote, but you did encourage others to support those grants. What do you say to someone who may kind of look at that and go, this just stinks? This is another politically connected family getting money for small businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, a constituent of yours comes up to you and says, this whole thing smells. What do you say to them?
Yeah, I'm going to say something I've never said publicly. One, because I don't, this is a very vulnerable space for me. I don't feel bad about carrying that legislation, fighting for it the way I did on that floor, creating the pathway for that programming. Once it got into SLDC, and when you understand and follow the process, I had no way of knowing that anybody that I knew was applying, was getting that close or getting that grant up until that exact point when the list was presented to me in front of me that day on that meeting to know. I just didn't. And it's not, and again, when I say vulnerable, it's not because of my position on the SLDC board, but I mean personally. I didn't know. I don't have that kind of relationship. So when the list was passed to me, and again, I wasn't even supposed to be in that meeting in person. I was supposed to do it virtually. I planned to do it virtually, but something told me, just go, because, you know, you're right here. And I made a U-turn and went back. And I'm so glad I did, because that means it's publicly aired and recorded live. When that list was passed to me, as soon as I looked down and read through the list and saw the names that I identified as my in-laws, I immediately message to the lawyer in the room and asked him if I could speak with him outside, and then was instructed to do what I had did and what I continued to do. When I said that I would support and encourage my colleagues on the board to vote for them. I wasn't talking about anybody specific. I was talking about the program, period. At that time, Rachel, we were years, almost going into 2 to 3 years out of the when they had first started that. So for me, and if you can go back and listen to prior meetings when I'm asking the former directors and the former people that were over there, what is taking so long for this money to move? These businesses have been waiting. COVID, you know, we're out of this time, out of COVID, and these businesses are still waiting. You know, what's going on? Then this different programming that happened, you know, and all of the different things, the changes that made. So my encouragement, and I hate that people have made it into that, was not for anyone specific. It was for the program, period. It was for businesses that I know that unfortunately at that point that I heard from had lost their business waiting. So again, it's frustrating for me. I would fight, Rachel, for that funding for businesses in North St. Louis today with all of the made-up confusion and controversy around it around me. I would fight for it the same way today that I fought for it on that floor in tears when I did and when I got it passed and when me and my colleagues passed. I won't say I got it passed because they believed in it too. And I believe many of them understand what this is and what the confusion that was created around it for whatever. It, quite frankly, it got caught up and then it got spun into a political season. So, when I said that I believe and I fight for it, funding for North St. Louis businesses, South St. Louis, I'm a former entrepreneur myself. So I believe in programming like that. I still do, and I still would.
Is this another one of the, it was out of the hands of the legislature by that point, situations?
By that point,
this is another implementation thing?
Absolutely. And even my role on the SLDC board and my vote that has now, I feel like has been taken away from me. There are some amazing businesses on those lists that I see and I can't now vote for just because of this, right? Who, quite frankly, and none of them have received any money to this day as we sit here on this podcast. And so I believe I'm in politics. I'm not naive to any of this. I understand what it is in so many different ways. And so I believe that my positioning and being, I don't give up on anything. I don't walk away from anything. I don't run from anything. But I can't let you carry me or get me caught up in stuff that I know is not the right. So when you see me not defending it, it's because I know that wasn't my role. I understand my role, and I know that some very good businesses have at this point finally gotten that funding and are finally able to program it and move it and move what they needed for their business. Some have changed because, you know, it's changed years later now. But I just don't think that it's all for naught. And for the ones and for any of the other ones, I don't want them to stop fighting either.
So it sounds like some businesses, some money is moving out of that program to some businesses, or are these businesses that have gotten grants from other sources?
No, there are some of that funding that has been programmed and has moved, and some great businesses. I won't say their names because I don't want them to get caught up in any of the foolery with me. But I know them, which is sad. You know, one of the things that people say, well, she knows them. Listen, before getting into politics, I knew people. I was a successful, successfully owned two salons, did hair for generations in the city of St. Louis. My family, my in-laws, and my personal family, we all worked and served in community. I know people. I could look at their list and identify a lot of people on that list. You know, so again, now it's a situation where you want to stand up and fight and brag and not, you know, brag on the success of businesses. I sometimes feel like I'm hindered and can't, and that's okay. But they know where I am and they know my heart and they know that they have a champion and a fighter in me.
Are you worried at all about the audit?
No, not for a second.
Is it a good thing that they're
yes.
digging into this?
I welcome. And in the one official statement I put out earlier on, during when it was really in the height of it for the campaign season, I welcome the audit. My statement was, I welcome it because for whatever, you know, whatever it is, I want it to come out and so that it will justify, clear, and honor the work and the service, the support, and hopefully the continued mission and funding that will come out of this. I welcomed it then. I welcome it now.
I know it's a little early, perhaps, to be talking about 2027, mm-hmm. but do you have thoughts about what you want to do in 2027? Are you going to stick to the 10th Ward? Are there other offices that you're potentially looking at?
Yeah, I have. You know what, Rachel? If I thought I could look at something else, I can't right now. I don't have the capacity to. You know, I don't even have the capacity to think about a reelection campaign for myself right now. If I did, I would feel like I would be robbing the time that I could be spending on helping my constituents get through this recovery and rebuilding phase that we're getting ready to be in. So 2027, I look at it like I know in political years, that's like next year. So
tomorrow,
you know, right,
almost.
Exactly. So, you know, I think about it like that. But again, I don't have the energy. You know, I know what comes with political campaigning season. What it comes with is going to be a lot of people blaming people for stuff they didn't do, can't do. You know, not their responsibility, but because it's hot topics and it gets people's emotions raring, then they'll be blaming and talking about the different things. The energy I spend going back and diffusing stuff like that, and I've been like this my whole political career, I could be spending getting something done that I know I can get done and helping people the way I know I can. And so that's what I focus on. I'm not a big campaigner in that way. I just like to show up authentically, truthfully, with my dedication and my commitment to my constituents like I do every day, whether I'm in campaign mode or I'm in just my regular day-to-day service mode. And then I think, and I believe that people see the difference, especially when they're at the most vulnerable points. They see the difference. So people get, there's a lot of misinformation and you get misled during campaign seasons. But the good thing about, one of the things about that is once candidates who win that way, once they get in, it doesn't last for long because it comes out really quick. It shows really quick.
Politically Speaking is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. 10th Ward Alderman Shamim Clark Hubbard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. You know, I love, first of all, Rachel, you know I'm a fan. Let's say, first of all, you know I've always been a fan. So thank you for the opportunity to come and connect with the listeners this way.
Until next time, so long.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.